Okay, great. So welcome back to lecture 6 of the standard model. So this lecture will introduce the Higgs mechanism, this key phenomenon that relates the very symmetric looking Lagrangian we've written down so far to the less symmetric world we seem to live in. The more generally this related idea of electroweak symmetry break. The model we've written down so far has this SU2 times U1 gauge symmetry called electroweak gauge symmetry, but it seems to be broken in the real world down to a smaller gauge symmetry, that of electromagnetism. And so we want to understand that. And that'll take us a couple of lectures to do. But it's great stuff. You'll learn all sorts of tons of interesting stuff involved in that story. Okay, so here we go. So first, I just wanted to finish up one final point from the last. This is the last slide from the previous lecture here. Okay, so we had gone to all this trouble to lay out all the rules of the game that you can play to derive this Lagrangian from our beloved table, my beloved table in any case. I hope your beloved table, or I hope, anyway, enough about that. So the last thing I just wanted to explain to make sure you could play the game right is that, when you see a covariant derivative appearing here, so for example, this covariant derivative appearing here, or this covariant derivative appearing here, the capital D. If you think about the explanation at the beginning of the previous lecture, we were discussing why the gauge field is valued in the Lie algebra. Well, what we really saw is that it's valued in the appropriate representation of the Lie algebra for whatever matter field is acting on. And so that means that when you expand, if you want to expand out this covariant derivative, what it will look like depends on what field it's acting on. So here, for example, if we expand out the covariant derivative acting on H, in full glory, well, it's the partial derivative part. But then in principle, we have three gauge symmetries. So you might have expected here to see three gauge fields, G mu, the SU3 gauge field, W mu, the SU2 gauge field, and E mu, the U1 gauge field. But we don't see the G mu here. Why is that? Well, that's because H, if we look back at its line in the table, it had a 1 under SU3. So it's transforms trivially under SU3, i.e., it doesn't transform. It's a scalar under SU3. So it doesn't. So the representation, the one-dimensional representation of SU3 is where you map every Lie algebra element to zero. That's the, in other words, where you map every group element to the identity element. So the G mu just doesn't appear here because it appears, but in the representation where it's just zero. Okay. Now, what about W mu? Well, H does transform as a doublet under W mu. So we have I times the SU2 gauge coupling constant G2, and then times the 2x2 representation or the usual adjoint representation of SU2. That's what this gauge field is. And then finally, if we look at the third column of the table, H has charge 1/2, and that's why here, instead of just having I times the U1 coupling constant times the U1 gauge field here, I have a 1/2 appearing here because it's really the charge 1/2 representation of this gauge field that appears in the covariant derivative. So to just take one more example, for this guy, for Q left, well, now in addition to the partial derivative, it does transform like a triplet under SU3. So here we have this 3x3 representation of G mu, which is just the normal adjoint representation times the SU3 gauge coupling constant. And then it also transforms like a doublet under SU2. So here's this 2x2 representation, which now acts. Remember, this thing has different indices, an SU3 index, which runs from 1 to 3. And that's what this. Oops. Sorry, someone's calling me. That I don't know who it is, but So this 3x3 matrix acts on the unshown here 3-component SU3 index. This 2x2 matrix acts on the unshown, you know, 2-component SU2 index alpha. Okay, so that's that matrix times the G2 SU gauge coupling times the SU2 gauge coupling, excuse me, G2. And then finally here we have the U1 gauge field times the U1 gauge coupling, and then times a 1/6, because in the table Q left has charge 1/6. Okay, so that's, if you just follow through the logic that we had before about what the gauge, what the covariant derivative sort of has to be in order to transform covariantly under gauge transformations, you'll see this is just exactly what you need to put in to the covariant derivative to achieve that. So it's a little bit different for every field. And the final thing I just wanted to point out is that, so now if we sort of, at the end of the game, you've written down all of these terms, and now let's ask, you know, one way to characterize how many independent terms you were able to write down is just how many different independent coefficients are there here that a priori are just independently specifiable numbers. Well, we have the 3 gauge couplings, G1, G2, and G3 for the 3 different gauge groups. We have these 2 parameters, m squared and lambda, which are of dimensions of mass squared and are dimensionless, which define the shape of the Higgs potential. There are these 4 3x3 complex matrices, the so-called Yukawa matrices, which correspond to the fact that for each of these 4 different types of Yukawa terms you can write down, there are 3 times 3 different terms, because you can, the first fermion can come from any of the 3 generations, and the second fermion in that term can come from any of the 3 generations. A priori, there's no symmetry relating those different terms, so they can all in principle have different coefficients, and they do. They are observed to all have different coefficients. And then finally, there's another 3x3. These Yukawa matrices are dimensionless matrices, if you go through the dimensional analysis. There's one more dimensionful 3x3 matrix, which is present only if there are right-handed neutrinos, where you can write down an explicit mass term, Majorana mass term for the right-handed neutrinos like this. Okay, so those are sort of that's a glimpse at all of the different independent constants in the standard model. Again, at the moment we don't know how to determine any of these except by measuring them. If anyone figured out, various people have proposed possible explanations for why there might be relations among them or something like that. But most of those have turned out to not be true, or in any case, maybe people don't. In any case, there's no agreed upon success of that sort. If there was an agreed upon success of that sort, that would be a huge breakthrough. That would almost certainly be a Nobel Prize. Okay. Yes.
Wouldn't the theta term as well be?
Yeah, that's a good, very good point. Yes, theta is another constant. You're absolutely right. Sorry, I should have written that down. And it just appears to be consistent with zero, but yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry. And what was the experimental situation in regards to the theta term?
So the experimental situation is that, you know, classically, it's a bit of a subtle story. Classically, this term is a total derivative, it turns out. So that means that if you vary it and ask what its contribution is to the classical equations of motion, there is no contribution. Vary it, the variation just identically vanishes. Nevertheless, quantum mechanically, it's non-zero. It's not trivial. And in practice, what it does, the main, most important detectable impact of it is that it gives rise to, breaks P and CP symmetry and gives rise to a, if it was non-zero, it would predict a non-zero electric dipole moment for the neutron, which is not observed. So that's why we have this very tight limit. Okay, so great. So let's just briefly recap the story so far. So far we met Yang-Mills theory, beautiful theory. The standard model is a particular example of a Yang-Mills theory. So we met the sort of table that most compactly expresses which particular Yang-Mills theory it is by giving its gauge group and the list of irreducible representations under which the matter fields transform. And then we sort of learned the rules of the game, whereby you can go from that table to the Lagrangian with the standard model. that we saw on the previous slide, and that from which you can sort of derive all of the rest of physics in principle, as far as we understand the laws of nature at present. In practice, of course, there's things about it like that in practice, because they're too complicated. What I want to explain now is that, so here, the next step is that I want to explain how to go from this Lagrangian that we've lovingly derived, and which is manifestly sort of makes the symmetries of the theory manifest, is manifestly symmetric under all of the symmetries. But in some sense, this way of writing the Lagrangian does not correctly capture the physics of the real world, because the vacuum state of the standard model, because of this phenomenon called the Higgs mechanism and spontaneous symmetry breaking that we want to talk about now. And so we want to somehow go from this, you know, the name of the game in the next two lectures is to go from this Lagrangian to the physical interpretation of the Lagrangian. What are the actual physical particles in it? What are their interactions? What's the actual physics of the real world that follows from this Lagrangian? So here, by the way, for the next couple of lectures, I'm going to look just at the minimal standard model. In other words, I've erased all of those terms that had been bracketed in blue involving the right-handed neutrino. I'm going to set those aside for the moment. We'll bring them. We'll discuss their effect again later. But for starters, we'll just get to know this guy. I've also suppressed the QCD theta term again, as mentioned, because we don't seem to observe it. It's not going to be particularly relevant to this story. Good. So. The reason that there's a kind of subtle story about relating this Lagrangian to the real world is because of this phenomenon of spontaneous symmetry breaking. So to explain this, let's have a look at, let's just focus on the Higgs terms in the Lagrangian. Okay, they're sort of the key thing for this first step in the story. So we have the kinetic term for the Higgs boson. And here I've only included the sort of terms in the kinetic term, just involving the Higgs itself. I've dropped all the different gauge fields from the covariant derivative, and then the potential term for the Lagrangian. Remember, the Lagrangian is always kinetic energy minus potential energy, which is why I've written minus V here. So V has these two terms. There's this term minus m squared h dagger h, and then plus lambda over 4 times h dagger h all squared. So if we draw the shape of this function, and so observationally, it didn't logically have to necessarily be the case, but observationally, the key point is that this coefficient minus m squared, it really is a negative number. It's really, you know, that's why we're writing it as minus m squared. So if we, well, meanwhile, lambda is a positive number. So if we draw this function v of h, potential function as a function of h, near the origin of in the field space, the minus m squared h squared term dominates. So this term looks like an upside down parabola near the origin. But then as we get further from the origin, this second term in the potential becomes more and more important, and it looks like a positive quartic function. So it eventually comes to dominate and turns the potential around and turns it back up. Okay, so we have this potential that we're trying to deal with, which I haven't done a very good job of. I'm not sure how clear it is from my picture here. My art skills have their limits, but. This is supposed to represent sort of supposed to look like the bottom of a symmetrical wine bottle here. So this is the sort of bottom of the wine bottle where it touches the table, and then you're supposed to imagine this surface all rotated around similarly. So if we take this Lagrangian density, and we imagine, going through the, you know, the normal exercise, you start with the Lagrangian, you can drive the Hamiltonian, or in field theory, you start with the Lagrangian density, you can drive the Hamiltonian density. I differentiate the Lagrangian with respect to the time derivative of the field, the corresponding canonical momenta, and then you rewrite, you define the Hamiltonian as momentum times P times Q dot minus the Lagrangian, and you can drive this Hamiltonian. I won't do it in front of you, but I recommend it as a good exercise. And so you'll see if you take these terms, the corresponding Hamiltonian looks like this. There's the sort of time derivative of the Higgs field squared, there's the spatial derivative of the Higgs field squared, and there's the potential term now with a plus sign. So the vacuum state is the state that minimizes the energy of this, and so it's going to be, so let's ask, you know, what would the configuration of the Higgs field be that would minimize this Hamiltonian? Well, these first two terms are positive definite now. They both come with plus signs, and they're both squared. So to minimize these, we would minimize these by taking h to be a constant, some constant value in spacetime. Then both of these terms would vanish, which is as small as they can get. Okay, so it's going to be, so in the vacuum, h is going to have some constant value. And then we just want to ask to determine what constant value. Well, we want to minimize this. We want the constant value that minimizes the potential. So in other words, we want something down here at the bottom as low as possible on the potential V of h. But then, as the picture indicates, you know, there's not a unique value of the Higgs field that minimizes it. There's some vacuum manifold here. In this picture, everywhere on the circle is equally good as a minimum of the potential. And because I can only draw a one-dimensional circle here, I've drawn it as one-dimensional. But you know, really, if you think about the Higgs field, it is this two-component vector with two complex components. So in other words, really, it's four real numbers. And h dagger h squared is a constant value over a three sphere. Well, we'll see this more clearly on the next slide, actually. But so I've drawn this as a one sphere, but really it's a three sphere. So there's this three sphere manifold of possible minima of the Higgs potential. And so which value will the Higgs field choose? Well, if they're perfectly degenerate, it just quote unquote spontaneously chooses one. So that's this. That's why this is called spontaneous symmetry breaking. Symmetry breaking because if the Higgs field had been up here, that's a symmetrical point on the potential. If I imagine the symmetry of the potential is that if I rotate it about the vertical axis here, the potential is invariant. And if the Higgs field was sitting at the top of the potential, it would also be invariant under that rotation. But instead, if it's somewhere down here, let's say, and as I rotate it, its value is not invariant. It gets sent around to the back. Okay, but so let's say it's, you know, like a pencil balanced on its tip that will fall in some direction. The Higgs field does choose some direction for its minimum, and that direction we will refer to that as the Higgs VEV by braces H, and we'll take that to be some constant. We call this. At constant value, the so-called vacuum expectation value of the Higgs field, or the VEV for short, that's the VEV of the full field H. And again, like I just mentioned, we say that if the VEV is non-zero in this case, that is so-called spontaneous symmetry breaking. Spontaneous symmetry breaking is the term for the situation where the vacuum state does not respect or is not invariant under the full symmetry of the theory. So that's called spontaneous symmetry breaking, often abbreviated SSB. So we want to describe how this works in the standard model. It's very helpful to go in two steps. Okay, so in the it's good to start by first thinking about spontaneous symmetry breaking in a theory with a global symmetry, where you're breaking a global symmetry. Okay, let me back up. So remember that there are two types of symmetries. There's global symmetries and gauge symmetries. Global symmetries, gauge symmetry, we've met already. That means you can do an independent symmetry transformation sort of at each point in space. Global symmetry means, you know, you do the same symmetry transformation at every point in space. The transformation does not depend on space-time coordinates. It's some finite dimensional symmetry, not the sort of continuously infinite dimensional symmetry. Do you have a question?
Yeah, I have a question about you saying the expectation value is not zero. So when you say it's spontaneously breaking, does the classical field literally takes a specific value on this sphere, or because I thought if the potential is symmetric, then the expectation value should still be zero because it can pick any point on the.
Yeah, very good point. So somehow in principle, it may be the case that. Maybe the case that actually the actual vacuum is an equal super, maybe, you know. Yeah, very, very good question. So maybe, you know, if you were thinking about a theory with a global symmetry, you might say, okay, maybe there's the configuration where the field is everywhere constant here, but then I could superpose that. I could take a superposition with another branch of the wave function where another term in the wave function where the field is constant everywhere here, and an equal superposition of states where the field is a constant everywhere around the potential, in which case you're absolutely right that the global expectation value of the field would still be a zero. So there's two things to say about that. You know, one is that even in a theory with a global symmetry where that doesn't happen in practice. So, for example, when you cool a magnet down, it ends up pointing in one direction. Well, maybe in the multiverse, it points in a superposition of all of those things. But the point is, that's what a quantum information person would call a Schrodinger's cat state, where you're superposing two different, very macroscopically distinct, or more than two different in this case, macroscopically distinct states. So in the real world, we don't see, you know, very, very macroscopic superpositions like that between an alive cat and a dead cat are unstable, presumably due to decoherence. Well, there's differences of interpretation about quantum mechanics, about exactly what the right explanation for why we don't see those is, but we don't see those. So this is like that. So in practice, in a situation like this, when the field spontaneously breaks symmetry in a macroscopic way like this, it actually, in the case where it's a global symmetry, it actually picks some direction, at least, let's say, in our branch of the wave function where we're doing LHC experiments involving that. Now, there's an extra subtlety. I mean, this is actually an important subtlety, which is that, you know, also this is a gauge theory we're talking about. So actually, there is some sense in which there are not actually independent vacua in the bottom of the potential here. These are all gauge equivalents. So, we'll get to this later. But there's a further sense in which that doesn't happen in a gauge theory because, in some sense, there's only one vacuum at the bottom of the potential. Yes.
Adding connects to the macroscopic feature of the vacuum. What is the experimental signature? Like, what is the experimental difference between the Higgs being, the field being on the right side versus the left side?
There is no observable difference. Those are, especially in the standard model, those are two gauge equivalent configurations. So they're literally in principle indistinguishable. But if it was a global symmetry, it would be like asking, what's the difference between having a magnet that's magnetized in this direction versus a magnet that's magnetized in this direction? Okay, except it's in that case, that's a little bit confusing way to say it because that's an actual direction in space. But my point is that they're all in some sense equivalent to one another, but that doesn't mean there's no. So, for example, if you somehow took a magnet that was all magnetized this way, and then you forced it to turn its magnetization to a different direction, in a case of a global symmetry, that is a detectable change in the properties of it. And so here, corresponding thing, the analogous thing would be, you know, this is kind of going to be confusing until I explain some further points about this, but you know, just like if you had a magnet that was pointing in this direction, and then some very powerful entity came down, you were embedded in it, let's say, and some powerful entity came down and turned it to be in this other direction. You know, you would detect various things, like your compass with needles would suddenly change direction and be no longer pointing forward, whatever. So the analogous thing here would be something like, you know, which particles are charged and which particles have which charge would change, it turns out. So that sort of thing, the properties of the particles in the basis in which you thought, which you had previously defined them, would change. There would be another basis where you could then switch to where the new particles would have the same properties that you said the old particles had in the old basis. So it would still be equivalent in that sense. But just like if you now turn with your compass in the new direction, now again the compass is pointing forward relative to you, and if the world that you're living in is otherwise symmetric, there's no, in some sense, new configuration looks just like the old one, except that you can detect a change. Okay, so let's see. The thing which I wanted to say was that when you break a global symmetry, and at 45, if you break a global symmetry, when you spontaneously break a global symmetry, the key phenomenon is that there is this theorem called Goldstone's theorem, which forces there to be massless bosons that appear, called Goldstone bosons, that are a sign of the symmetry breaking.
This symmetry breaking is basically a consequence of the special shape of potential we choose, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't have any observational consequence where the vacuum reside. So couldn't be design the potential some way that it doesn't really break the symmetry. And
In a sense, yes. In the coming slides, we'll see exactly in what sense that's true. So we'll see how to determine when a scalar field does get a vacuum expectation value, you know, depending on what the symmetries of the theory are and what VEV it obtains, some of the symmetries will be broken and some of them won't be broken by that VEV. And so we'll see, you know, how to determine which is which. And in principle, you could write down theories where a field obtains a VEV that maybe doesn't break any of the symmetry. That's possible. But that's not the way it is in the standard.
Then why we stick to this? Because you said observationally apparently doesn't have consequences.
The symmetry breaking definitely does have consequences. It'll give an explanation for why particles have the various properties. We will be discussing the consequences. Sorry, I meant to say that two different but equivalent symmetry breakings are in some sense observationally indistinguishable, but the difference between not breaking symmetry and breaking symmetry that is okay. So in gauge theory, I was just going to say that instead when you break symmetry, you instead get this phenomenon called the Higgs mechanism. So instead of getting massless Goldstone bosons, instead get this phenomenon of the Higgs mechanism, where instead some of the gauge fields in the theory eat those Goldstone bosons and become massive vector bosons, W and Z bosons in the standard model. So Let's try to understand all that. Okay, so first, by way of introduction, let's remember sort of what the basic idea is of perturbative quantum field theory. So you know the usual idea is that quantum field theory, you're given some Lagrangian that depends on some fields, but if it was perfectly quadratic in the fields, then it would basically just be a bunch of harmonic oscillators. You could by working in Fourier space, hopefully you've met this at some level in an introduction to quantum field theory. If you break it into Fourier modes, the amplitude of each Fourier mode is like a harmonic oscillator. In quantum mechanics, you know you can exactly solve the harmonic oscillator. Classically, you can solve the equations of motion. Quantum mechanically, you can find all the energy eigenstates and the dynamics, etc. So if we had a perfectly quadratic Lagrangian, life would be grand. We would be able to solve everything about it. But in practice, usually what we want to deal with are field theories that are not so simple. They involve higher powers, so they don't just involve field terms that have, you know, two powers of the fields. They're not just quadratic in fields. They involve higher powers of the fields, and in general, we can't solve such theories exactly, either classically or quantum mechanically. So instead, we do perturbation theory. We break the theory into a part which is quadratic in the fields, which we can solve exactly, and then the rest of it. Okay, all the other terms which are not quadratic in the fields. And if we ignore the rest of it for the moment, we can solve the free part and identify what are all the particles in the theory and their masses and how do they behave, because it's just basically solving a fancy version of the harmonic oscillator. And those free theories in particular, in the language of Feynman diagrams, tell us, you know, what are all the different types of lines that can appear in the Feynman diagrams? What are all the different external and internal lines that can appear? But then the interaction terms, every different interaction term, by an interaction term, I mean a term that involves more than two fields, three or more fields. Every one of those interaction terms is represented in the Feynman diagram. Those are the things that allow particles to scatter off of one another in different ways. So every one of those gives rise to a possible vertex that I can put in the Feynman diagram. So if I have a term with five fields, well, then I write down that means that I'm allowed in my Feynman diagrams to have three phi lines join at a vertex. Okay, so these give particles the ability to run into each other. The lines in the Feynman diagram to split and or join with each other. And all Feynman diagrams are they just a way of keeping track. When you do perturbation theory, there's all these terms that appear in perturbation theory, an infinite number, but some of them are more important and some of them are less important. And the Feynman diagrams are just a way of an accounting device that just lets you keep track of all the different terms in the perturbation theory calculation of some particular quantity. And they give a nice reason they're so popular is because they give a very beautiful physical interpretation to each of those terms, some actual physical process in which particles are running into each other and splitting and absorbing. Okay, so as I said, this quadratic part of the Lagrangian is the unperturbed or free Lagrangian. This part, which is all the cubic and higher terms in the fields, like phi cubed or like h times psi bar psi, the Yukawa couplings we saw, these are treated as small perturbations. Perturbation theory only works if that's a good assumption. And these are the so-called interaction terms, because they give rise to the vertices where in Feynman diagrams where different particles interact. And so from this part of the Lagrangian, we read off what the physical particles are, what the lines in the Feynman diagram are, what their masses and propagators are. And from this part, as I said, we read off the interaction vertices and the Feynman rules for those vertices. Okay, so let's briefly remind ourselves what are the kinds of free Lagrangians we encounter that we'll encounter in the standard model. Well, there's the free Lagrangian for a scalar field. That's the Klein-Gordon Lagrangian. So that's a kinetic term like 1/2 d mu phi d mu phi, and minus a mass term 1/2 m squared phi squared. Just to emphasize, you see that those terms are both quadratic in phi. For the spinner field, well, that's the Dirac Lagrangian. There's the kinetic term, which is the Dirac kinetic term we've been seeing previously. And then there's the corresponding mass term for a Dirac field. Now, I should say there's actually several different type of free spinner Lagrangians we can encounter. What I just described this as the Dirac Lagrangian, and that is usually when you first meet it, you're learning in a QFT course about a Dirac spinner with four independent complex, a column of four independent complex numbers. So if we split it into the top two left-handed components, the parts that are transformed left chirally under the Lorentz transformations, and the bottom two components that transform into each other under right chiral representation of the Lorentz transformation, those are two independent, completely independent spinners, four completely independent complex numbers. So that's called a Dirac spinner. But there's another thing which you can do, which is compatible with Lorentz invariants, which is that you can take those two to be not independent. So instead, we can have our same right-handed spinner as the bottom two components, but now instead of having an independent left-handed spinner as the top two components, we can take the charge conjugate. Remember last time we saw how to take the complex conjugate and then multiply by I gamma 2 to get the charge conjugate of a spinner. And we saw that the charge conjugate of a right-handed spinner is a left-handed spinner, so it lives up here. So that's another perfectly valid four-component spinner, except now it only contains two independent complex numbers because the top two components are determined from the bottom two. So instead of having four independent physical degrees of freedom, which an ordinary Dirac spinner does, spin up and spin down for both particles and antiparticles, a Majorana spinner has only half the number of independent numbers in it, and so it has only half the number of physical degrees of freedom. And then, alternatively, there's another thing which can happen, which is that, if we just take this expression for psi and plug it in here, plug it into this Lagrangian, that is still perfectly correct Lagrangian, but now that's called the Lagrangian for a Majorana fermion. So that's the Majorana kinetic term, and that would be the Majorana mass term. And we'll see that neutrinos, if you include right-handed neutrinos in the standard model, they have mass terms like that. And finally, okay, so that's Dirac and Majorana spinners. What about Weyl spinners? A Weyl spinner is if you just include, you know, either the top two components or the bottom two components, but not the other one. So here's a left-handed Weyl spinner. What could we write down for its quadratic Lagrangian? Well, we can write down a kinetic term like this. We saw last time that is Lorentz invariant and non-zero. But we saw that if we tried to write down the corresponding mass term, like minus m psi l bar psi, that would vanish. So we can't write down a mass term for a Weyl spinner. A Weyl spinner is massless. So it can have this sort of kinetic term, or it can have this sort of kinetic term. And so the spinners that appear in the standard model are Weyl spinners when we write it in the way we've written it so far, in the explicit, in the manifestly symmetric form. But what we want to see is, what we'll see later in this lecture and in the next lecture, is that when you spontaneously break the symmetry of the standard model, when the Higgs gets its VEV, the spinners reorganize themselves. So what formerly looked like a bunch of Weyl spinners get grouped together into Dirac-like spinners that do have non-zero masses. So that somehow the Higgs gives those fermions their masses. So we want to understand that point. And then finally, okay, so that's the free Lagrangian for a spin zero or a scalar particle, and for a spin one half or spinner field. Then there's finally for a spin one or vector field, the free Lagrangian looks like this. The kinetic term is the ordinary Maxwell Lagrangian for electromagnetism that we've seen before. But then now it can also have there's another Lorentz invariant term we can write down, a mass term, which is like minus one half m squared a mu, I should both say a mu. Now this breaks this term. The reason you don't normally include it in electromagnetism is because it breaks gauge invariance. And so that's why also why you don't see those terms appearing in the Lagrangian that we've written down so far, written in the manifestly symmetric form. However, again, something that we want to understand is that after some of that symmetry is broken by the Higgs obtaining its VEV, we will get fields including mass terms like this, massive fields, and particularly the W and Z bosons will have a part of the quadratic part of their Lagrangian will look like that. Okay, and so finally, yeah, in all of these cases, you know, if you take any of these quadratic Lagrangians and vary it to get the equations of motion, you know, the Dirac equation or the Klein-Gordon equation or the massive analog of the Maxwell equation, you'll see that the solution of the equation, you know, that a plane wave like e to the I kx, where k mu is the momentum four vector, is a solution of the classical equation of motion if k mu squared is equal to minus m squared, where m is the parameter appearing in each of these Lagrangians. So that's an exact solution of the equations of motion in those cases, and that's why that's how we know to refer to these parameters as the mass parameter, because it ends up requiring that the four momentum satisfy the usual mass shell constraint that, you know, e squared is equal to p squared plus m squared, or e squared minus m squared is equal to, anyway, you know what I mean? E squared is equal to p squared plus m squared. But at the quadratic level, again, these are, you know, a general solution. You can just take a superposition of all these different plane waves, and they just don't talk to each other. All these different plane waves quantum mechanically represent particles moving with four momentum k mu and k mu prime, et cetera. But they all just superpose, so meaning that all the waves pass through each other without scattering and just keep going on forever, sort of doing nothing. So the theory is very simple, but doesn't do much. Okay, so how to get at the physics? Well, there's three steps. So here again, this is just the minimal standard model Lagrangian, which we saw before. So now I'm going to split it into the first two lines, which I've called the bosonic terms. I just call them the bosonic terms because there's no fermion or spinner fields appearing in these top two lines. It's purely the gauge fields and the scalar fields, which will be described by both, which are bosons. And then the final two lines I'm calling those the fermion terms because they do each involve two fermion fields, two spinner fields. Okay, and now, so again, now we want to extract what are the physical particles and interactions from this Lagrangian. We'll do it in three steps, okay? So we're gonna plug in the non-zero VEV for the Higgs field. That's step one. That's step zero, maybe. And then step one is to then, once we've split the Higgs field into its VEV plus a deviation from the VEV called the Higgs boson, we will first look at the first two lines and identify the quadratic terms, and those will tell us what the bosons are in the standard model. And then we will find the quadratic terms in the second line, and those will tell us about the fermions in the standard model and what are their masses, et cetera, the physical ones that you will produce at the LHC, for example. And then finally, once we know what the sort of physical particles are, et cetera, we'll be able to look at the remaining terms, the non-quadratic terms, and identify basically what are the interaction vertices in the standard model. Okay, so final two slides, very, very, very valuable, two very valuable concepts, I would say. So we want to learn about, in this slide, it's a sort of lightning introduction to spontaneous symmetry breaking of a global symmetry and Goldstone's theorem. And then on the next slide, it'll be the analogous story, breaking of a gauge symmetry and the Higgs mechanism. And so I just want to, I think it's to make things less confusing, I'm introducing this. The end of this lecture, the rest of this lecture will just be introducing these, if you want, conceptually, without actually going in and doing the work of breaking the symmetry in the standard model Lagrangian itself, but just telling you how the story, conceptually speaking, how it's going to go. And then in the next lecture, as I say at the beginning of the next lecture, we'll actually carry this out for the bosonic part of the standard model Lagrangian. Okay, so good. So how would things go? Imagine for a second, which is not true, but imagine that the standard model symmetry SU3 times SU2 times U1 was a global symmetry, Okay, and but the Higgs potential has this shape, and it gets a VeV that breaks that symmetry. Okay, so let's first imagine what, let's see what would happen then. So in the standard model, the Higgs field, remember, is a doublet. It's a field with two complex components. So here I've written that as the first complex number is, so it has four real components, phi 1, phi 2, phi 3, and phi 4. So the top component I'm writing is phi 1 plus I phi 2, and the bottom is phi 1, phi 3 plus I phi 4. Okay, so now if we look at the bottom of this potential, you know, the in the Lagrangian only depends on this quantity h dagger h. So if we expand out what h dagger h is in terms of these real field components, it's phi 1 squared plus phi 2 squared plus phi 3 squared plus phi 4 squared. And that at the bottom of the potential, that's just equal to some constant. Okay, but that, you know, phi 1 squared plus phi 2 squared plus phi 3 squared plus phi 4 squared is equal to a constant. That's the equation for a 3 sphere. You know, phi 1 up to phi 1 squared plus dot 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 up to phi n squared equals a constant. Well, that constant is the radius squared of the n minus 1 dimensional sphere of that radius. So the vacuum manifold, one can say, in this theory, is a 3 sphere. So as we said before, but the actual VeV will pick some value on that 3 sphere. So, you know, instead of being everywhere on the vacuum manifold, it'll be somewhere, say over here. And so let's, without loss of generality, take that particular, take the VeV to be have this form. But it's the particular point that it's at is the one where phi 1 and phi 2 are both 0, and phi 3 is non-zero, and phi 4 is 0. So in other words, the bottom component is non-zero but real. And as a matter of convention, to stick with the standard model convention, I'm calling it, I'm writing it as 1 over root 2, 0 v. Okay, so then what happens? Well, remember that the full, the Lie algebra, which generates the full Lie group, the full symmetry of the standard model, or the globe, this global, hypothetical global analog of the standard model, is SU3 plus SU2 plus U1. So that's an 8-dimensional plus a 3-dimensional plus a 1-dimensional Lie algebra. So we have a 12-dimensional Lie algebra V. That's the full symmetry group. But then let's think about how that 12-dimensional Lie algebra acts on H, on the Higgs field. Well, there's actually, you know, only four of those generators that actually act non-trivially on H. Because remember, we saw that H is a singlet under SU3, and so in its kinetic term, you know, in its covariant derivative, there just is no SU3 gauge field. So those eight generators just don't even talk to the Higgs field. So the ones that do are the three SU2 generators, T1, T2, and T3. So those are just, remember, 1/2 times the three poly sigma matrices. And then finally, there's the hypercharge generator. Well, the hypercharge generator that acts on the Higgs field is 1/2 times the identity matrix, because the Higgs field has charge 1/2. So if you took e to the I times this generator y, you would see that that would just take the whole field to e to the I times 1/2 phi, and overall multiply it by an overall complex phase. Okay, so those are the four generators that act non-trivially on the field H. But then what if we think about which ones act non-trivially on the VeV of H, this particular VeV that we chose up here? So now there is a, within that 4D space of generators, there's a 1D subspace that also acts trivially on H. So in particular, if we look at this combination Q, called the electric charge generator, which is just the sum of the Y generator and the T3 generator. Well, that's just, if you just add those two matrices, you'll see that's 1, 0, 0, 0. And if you just take that matrix and act with it on this, expression for the Higgs field, for the Higgs VeV, you'll see that Q times H is equal to 0. So in other words, if you if you look at the group element generated by that Lie algebra element, e to the iq acting on h, well, e to the iq, you've just expand that exponential as a sum, you know, in the usual way. If you expand the exponential as a power series, you'll see all the terms except for the zeroth term vanish because q acts on h and kills it. So e to the iq is just e to the iq acting on h is just 1 times h. It just leaves h alone. Okay? Yeah.
This is true only for a particular choice of
h. Exactly. So that's a very good point. So which combination of generators leaves h invariant, leaves the VEV invariant, depends on exactly which VEV we choose. So for this particular choice of VEV, it's this particular combination of generators so whichever choice we had chosen, there's some particular linear combination that leaves it invariant, and that would be the physical electric charge. Okay, so the story, just to continue, would be that, so in fact, there's 8 plus 1, or 9 generators. There's a 9-dimensional subalgebra W of the full Lie algebra V. So the subalgebra is SU3C. Oh, by the way, I forgot to mention, people sometimes write the Lie algebra of the standard model with these labels on it to tell you the physical meaning. So SU3, they write a little C, which stands for color. That's the color gauge group or strong force gauge group. And then SU2L stands for left. That's a reminder that it only acts on the left-handed fermions in the standard model. And then U1Y stands for hypercharge. And so then with that same notation, the unbroken gauge group is the same SU3 as before, SU3 color, but then there's this U1Q, U1 electromagnetism is the remaining unbroken part of this original 4-dimensional Lie algebra SU2 times U1Y. So that subalgebra all annihilates H. So that any element of that 9-dimensional subalgebra acting on the VEV H vanishes. So those are called the unbroken generators, or the unbroken gauge symmetry in the standard model, SU3 times U1 electromagnetism. That's the unbroken symmetries of nature in the room right now at low energies. What about the remaining, 12 minus 9 equals 3-dimensional quotient space? So if you ever have a vector space and a subspace, you can take the quotient of those two, and that's a 3-dimensional vector space. And that's basically the 3-dimensional vector space of generators that do not annihilate the vacuum. They, when they act on H, they give a non-zero answer. Or in other words, when you exponentiate those generators, instead of leaving the Higgs VEV alone, they would move it along. They would move it somewhere else on the vacuum manifold. So it's no coincidence that there's three of these, and that the vacuum manifold here, we said, was a 3-dimensional sphere, a 3-dimensional manifold. These are exactly, these three non-vanishing generators are exactly parameterizing the three different ways in which you can move the field along the vacuum manifold. So those are called the broken generators. And if this was a global symmetry, it turns out, I mean, we'll see why this is next time, but it turns out that, just to summarize, that there would be three massless scalar bosons here. So we start off with these four scalar fields, phi1 through phi4, but the story is that one of them, the field in the radial direction here, would, one of them, when we write the Lagrangian in terms of these four scalar fields, well, if we write it in if we split it into the field that kind of parameterizes moving in the radial direction around the VEV, you see the potential is curved in that direction, and so that would, in that direction, the potential would have a non-zero m squared phi squared, where phi is the field moving in that direction, but in all the other directions, which move along the potential is completely flat in those other three directions. And so along those directions, it would have 0 times phi squared, where phi is the field in those other directions. So those would all be massless directions for the scalar field. So here we would have three massless scalar bosons, which are called the Goldstone bosons, coming from this spontaneous symmetry breaking. And in general, very generally, you get one massless boson for each generator in V mod W. So that's Goldstone's theorem, that the number of massless scalar fields you get when you spontaneously break a global symmetry is always equal to the dimension of V, the full symmetry group, the full Lie algebra, mod W, the subalgebra that is left, that leaves the VEV invariant. Okay, so that would be the story for a global symmetry. So what happens when we make it a local symmetry? And instead of Goldstone's theorem, we're talking about the Higgs mechanism. Okay, so it's general things are closely parallel. 2 minutes. Well, maybe instead of rushing through this last slide, I'll just leave it for the next time because I'd like to just not rush it so much.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Could you explain why we get three massless bosons?
Yeah. So, physically, the way I would say it is that. If we expand the Lagrangian about this point here, okay, in terms of scalar fields, well, there's a four-dimensional space of scalar fields we're living in. So this is the same four-dimensional space of scalar fields we started with. Now we're going to split those four dimensions into let's move into a basis where some of those scalar fields parameterize moving along or are pointing tangent to the vacuum manifold. If I move in those directions, I move along the vacuum manifold, so the potential doesn't change. They're perfectly flat directions locally. So those ones will, when I expand the potential around those directions, the potential will just be flat. So the coefficient of the phi squared along those directions will just be zero. On the other hand, there are the directions perpendicular to the vacuum manifold, and they in general will not be zero. And you see that in the shape of the potential here, that in that perpendicular direction, the potential curves, and so those bosons have a non-zero. That's the idea. And then I was just saying that it's not a coincidence that the dimension of the vacuum manifold, 3 in this case, is equal to the dimension of V mod W. That always has to be. As I say, maybe just in a word, I'll explain this slide better next time, but in a word, the whole story is very parallel when we're talking about a gauge symmetry, except now, in addition to having three Goldstone bosons, three massless bosons corresponding to the three dimensions of the vacuum manifold, we also have the three gauge bosons associated with those three generators that got broken. And what happens is that each of those three gauge bosons combines with one of the three Goldstone bosons to form a vector boson which does have a mass. So three of the bosons, for the same reason that in the previous story we got three massless scalar fields, in the Higgs mechanism version of the story, the gauge symmetry version of the story, we'll get three massive vector fields. So. Those are the W plus W minus and Z boson in the standard model, but okay, we'll do it better next time. Any other questions?